Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Are the world's many faiths paths to the same God? For years now, legions of the wise and well-meaning have said yes. My guest today, Stephen Prothrow, says no. The great religions, he says, address fundamentally different problems with different solutions. They are not paths, he says, to one mountaintop. To many, that may seem a retreat from hope, even truth. Prothrow says it's realism with hope and truth of its own. This hour on Point, my guest says, God is not one. You can join the conversation. How do you see it? Many paths, one God, no God at all? And where does hope lie here? Do you long for one cosmic universal or not? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now in our studio is Stephen Prothrow. He's a professor of religion at Boston University and author of many books, including American Jesus and the best-selling Religious Literacy. His new book is God is Not One, the 8 Rival Religions That Run the World and Why Their Differences Matter. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Stephen Prothrow, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me, Tom. Good to be here.
Who said God was one?
Oh, a lot of people. I mean, the Dalai Lama is one who says that all the religions are basically different paths up the same mountain. Probably the best-selling book in religious studies over the last couple generations by Houston Smith, The World's Religions, also makes this claim that the differences are really inessential and, in essence, religions are basically all the same. And, of course, Gandhi was an advocate of this view as well.
Houston Smith used the famous foothills and mountaintop metaphor, I think, that the differences are in the foothills, but you get to the mountaintop and what?
That's right. You get to the mountaintop and then people will fill in the answer differently. They'll say, well, it's one God that you get at the top. The Hindus will tend to say, well, you have this experience of the union of the self with the divine, or perhaps it's compassion. This is Karen Armstrong emphasizes this idea that the religions are all basically about compassion.
We're going to hear in this hour from a theologian who says, yes, indeed, once you get to the sort of zenith of insight and understanding, it's one God. But you make a very combative case that it's not. You call the view that there's one God at the end of all the paths naive.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think, you know, it's a view that I heard when I was an undergraduate in college and even when I was in graduate school, and it never really sat right with me. It never really made sense to me. If you talk to religious people and they tell you what their commitments are, what their beliefs are, what their practices are, they're very specific about it, right? So we have, you know, the 5 pillars of Islam and you're supposed to go on the Hajj. Well, Christians aren't supposed to go on the Hajj. And then you can say, well, but then...
That's the foothills.
Yeah, that's the foothills. And who cares about the Hajj? But of course, Muslims say, well, it's one of the 5 pillars. It's not an inessential part. It's an essential part. Or the 5 prayers in Islam, praying 5 times a day. Is that inessential? Is that unimportant? Or, and this is where I get the title of my book, monotheism itself. You know, we have religions that say God is one, that there's one God. We have religions that say God is many, like Hinduism classically has said that. Mm-hmm. And we have religions that say there's no God at all.
Buddhism
that says none. So is that inessential? So what's required to make them all one is a kind of condescension from the outside that says, well, the things that people inside the religion say matter to them don't really matter. What really matters is, and then you kind of fill in your own personal bias about what really matters, that, oh, there's really one God, or, oh, there's this experience of union with the divine, or, oh, it's really about ethics and about compassion.
You call that condescension. To a lot of people, that vision of all religions leading to one mountaintop is a source of great hope, a hope for peace, among other things.
I think that's right, and I think that's one source of its staying power, is that it sort of seems to be almost immoral to point out the differences between the religions. I mean, the history behind this, of course, is that classically, the people who have stressed the differences across religions have done it in order to say, okay, see, all the religions are different, and mine is the one true religion.
And right? here's my sword, maybe. Even.
Right, and then maybe we need to kill the other mm-hmm. people, right? Mm-hmm. So Christians have done this, Muslims have done this. The religions are really different. There's two categories, the true religions, which is only one, which is mine, and then the false religions. So this view is a response to that. And in fact, some of the people who have pushed it, like Houston Smith himself, mm-hmm. have been children of missionaries who have been overseas trying to convert people to their one true faith, and they're looking around and they're learning the languages and they're learning about Confucianism or they're learning about Buddhism, and they're saying, you know, I don't buy this. I don't buy that there's one religion that's better than the others, that one religion has a monopoly on truth. Maybe all religions are preaching the same truth. So it has a kind of ethical impulse that it grows out of. But it's just not true. And I don't think that the basis for interreligious understanding or global cooperation can ever be basically falsehoods that are perpetrated on us in the name of some sort of higher morality.
I was absolutely fascinated by your book. It is, in a way, a primer on the religions because you go into the differences one by one. Having said that, you know, I was raised up, yes, in a what happened to be a Christian environment, but it was also one that was very open to this idea of one mountaintop. It happened to be very open to that. And, you know, so I've got a lot of people early in my life who I really respected who powerfully asserted this. It's once you get to the transcendent, once you get to the infinite, it's all one. You say no. We're going to talk about that a lot in this hour, but I wish you'd lay out some of the differences. You've got eight religions here, and you give each a kind of you give us a quick summary of what it's about, and it begins to show us, we'll talk more, but it begins to show us how they've got different emphases and maybe don't end up on the same mountaintop. Walk us through the eight that you've chosen. It's not every religion in the world, you're quick to say, but it's eight big ones.
Right. Well, one way I think about them is with a sort of problem-solution model. So one way that the religions differ from one another is they don't accept the idea that the Christian problem of sin is the problem that they want to attack. So classically, Christians will say the problem is sin and the solution is salvation. So if you think about terms of problem and solution, you can say, well, what about Buddhism? Well, Buddhism doesn't believe in sin. Neither does Hinduism. So they're not going to accept either sin as the problem or salvation, which is the elimination of
the
sin.
The Christian answer.
As the goal, mm-hmm. right?
Okay, so Buddhism, it's what? Suffering.
So Buddhism, it says, right, the human problem is suffering. How do we get rid of it? Their mountaintop is going to be not salvation with Jesus, but nirvana, which is the absence of suffering. And they're going to try to get up that mountain through techniques that will get rid of suffering, like meditation or like chanting. Whereas Christians are going to use techniques that are going to get up their mountain of salvation, such as faith or works or some, you know, combination of the two. That's mm-hmm. the great Protestant-Catholic disagreement. Mm-hmm. Hindus are saying, here's the problem. We keep being reborn over and over and over again. This isn't the problem of Christianity because Christians classically don't believe in reincarnation. So mm-hmm. how can that be a problem that mm-hmm. they need to solve?
Right.
But Hindus saying that's the problem. How do we overcome it? We overcome that through spiritual liberation, through some kind of union between the human being and God. And that is moksha. That is what will cause us not to be reborn. So the religions are really, you know, working at these things very differently. Confucianism, for example, isn't really worried about the afterlife. It's a this-worldly tradition. That's one of the unique beauties of it, that it really focuses on the problem of disharmony, of social disorder, mm-hmm. and it's trying to create social order. How do you do that? It says, well, you do it through learning, you do it through etiquette, and you do it through rituals.
And Taoism is the direct rebellious response to that.
Exactly. And that's one intriguing thing. If you look at these religions that are in conversation with one another, they often develop their problem-solution models very much over against the other. So the Taoists say, we don't want to be Confucians. Confucianism is about this conformity and this restriction of the individual so that we can have our society, you know, get along with one another. And mm-hmm. we're told, like, oh, I need to, you know, kowtow to my husband if I'm a wife, and I need to kowtow to the ruler if
Taoists
I'm a subject.
Say, forget it. I want Taoists to be natural.
Right. Naturalness, simplicity, mm-hmm. getting out and, you know, going into the mountains. Lao Tzu, who left behind the Tao Te Ching, which is the mm-hmm. most translated scripture after the Bible in Western society. You know, that scripture is he's leaving civilization. He's right at the edge. He's about to go wandering in the mountains. And this border guard says, well, you're a wise man. What's your wisdom? And he says, oh, well, here, I'll slash out, you know, 5,000 words. Here it is. And that's his text. And then that becomes the scripture of Taoism. And where does he go? He just disappears into the mountains and he's gone.
Then there's Yoruba all over Africa, in the Caribbean as well, with its own problem and solution.
Right. So the Yoruba tradition, which is usually not included among you know, the top religions, but I argue that it is one of them, with perhaps 100 million people adherents, starts in West Africa, moves over through the slave trade to Brazil, South America, mm-hmm. Central America, the Caribbean, and up in the United States as mm-hmm. well. This is a tradition that is often associated with sacrifice. In fact, Santeria came up in a U.S. Supreme Court case in the mm-hmm. in the 90s when some people in Florida were trying to get rid of animal sacrifice there. Mm-hmm. But it's a tradition of divination, sacrifice, but I focus on it as the problem being disconnection human to human, disconnection between humans and, we might say, the gods. There's debate about if that they're really gods. They're called orishas. Mm-hmm. And disconnection between humans and the natural world. And how do we get back in connection to that? We get back in connection through these diviners who are able to tell us what our destiny really is. And then we need to follow that destiny help the world.
I think we've got six out of eight there. It leaves Islam and Judaism. And we've got a minute before the break. I don't know. give us a piece.
Okay, so Islam, the problem is pride. This is so interesting.
Human pride.
Human
arrogance.
Pride, that we think we are self-sufficient. This is the most monotheistic, arguably, of the great religions. Mm-hmm. We are too proud to submit to God, and the solution is to submit to God. That's why we
Islam
have prayer.
Islam means submission.
That's right. So that's Islam, and then Judaism is maybe the trickiest on this problem solution, but I talk about the problem being exile. We're in exile from the stories that we should be telling. We're in exile from God. We're in exile from the center where we should be. That center is Jerusalem, the Promised Land. And we need to return somehow as a people through a combination of following the law and telling the story.
So we see a lot of differences there and a lot of different points in the compass that they're pointing. And if Houston Smith said to you, all that is foothills, Stephen Prothero, all that is foothills. There's still one supreme.
Right. What I would say is, well, if we want to talk foothills and mountains, all these people are going up different mountains. They're not going up the same, and they're using very different tools and very different techniques to ascend to the various peaks.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about whether religions are all different paths to the same God. My guest today says no. Stephen Prothero's new book is God is Not One, the Eight Rival Religions That Run the World and Why Their Differences Matter. We're going to hear in just a few minutes from a theologian in Chicago who says, well, when you reach the infinite, maybe it is all one. Prothero makes the case. He makes it in some pretty pugnacious language that it is not. What about that? I mean, if you're right, if it's not all one, to say it's all one is pretty powerful stuff. It says, look, let's not sweat these differences between us, because when we get to the Promised Land, whatever, however that's described, we're all brothers and sisters there. So let's all settle down here and not be at each other's throats over religion. That would seem like a powerful argument for peace.
Well, I have a couple responses to that. The first is that the idea that the religions are one actually leads us into conflict. If you look at the situation in Iraq, for example, when we sent our troops into Iraq, part of what we were doing was imagining, A, that there really wasn't that much of a difference between Christianity and Islam, in the sense that
we could go in with our values and
right.
say, ta-da.
We could go in with our values and they would want our values.
Mm-hmm.
But also, we didn't know that there was a difference between Sunni and Shia. So once Saddam Hussein is gone and all of a sudden we get this civil war, essentially, between the Sunni and the Shia, we're surprised because we're thinking like, well, they're all Muslims. Like, why are they fighting? So I think that there are situations in the world in which religious conflicts are there and simmering. And if we are pretending, for example, in Kashmir, that, you know, where we have two nuclear powers, the Hindu majority state of India and the Muslim majority state of Pakistan, that really there isn't any difference between Islam and Hinduism. I mean, we really don't need to factor these religious differences into our diplomacy. That's just crazy and naive. That's just not going to work. And the other argument I would make is that if you think about any other arena of human endeavor, like when do we ever say that political parties need to be essentially the same in order to work together, or that economic systems are not essentially different? Like, nobody claims that communist China is somehow the same as American democracy, either economically or politically. And when we think about our relationships with one another, who says that the key to a good marriage is being exactly the same as your spouse? Isn't the argument that we should understand the differences? And only when we come to understand the differences can we somehow respect the differences that we have with one another and have actual tolerance. Tolerance doesn't make any sense unless it's between mutually conflicting positions.
Tolerance is quite different, I think, from the argument at the mountaintop, God is one. That's not tolerance. That's saying
you don't need tolerance. You don't need any tolerance because they're all the religions are all the same.
But in a way, you're oversimplifying. I mean, even Houston Smith, he's saying the foothills are different. He's saying don't be too fraught over that, because once you get up to, I mean, don't you feel kind of presumptuous telling Mahatma Gandhi and the Dalai Lama and Houston Smith and, you know, all these, you guys are wrong? Is it possible that it's just a matter of altitude? Maybe you're down at the altitude of the worldly expression of religions. Maybe they're saying something different.
I do think altitude has something to do with it, in the sense that all of these people who make the claim that religions are one typically head toward mystics. They either head towards ethics, where the religions are basically the same, and I'll admit that on
the golden rule,
right?
Kind of.
They're basically the golden rule. I mean, no religion says you should, you know, throw your mother into the street or, you know, have sex with your brother. Mm-hmm. So religions are basically the same on ethics. But the altitude is a good question, because the all religions are one people typically focus on mysticism. They focus on these mystics who have these crazy experiences. Mm-hmm. And then they say, oh man, I felt this sort of swimming and losing of my identity into God.
You call it crazy. Others would call it the ultimate experience of divinity.
But it's a 1,000,000% of the expression of the religions of the world. I mean, all religions know that the mystical experience is something that's odd
rare
and unusual.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I mean, I think when we talk about religions, we need to talk about religions as they are on the ground, which
but
means
even ordinary
people.
Yeah, but they sip at the stream of rapture, ecstasy, I don't know. I mean, isn't that what keeps a lot of people coming back to religion? They may not be the great sages on the mountaintop,
right,
but they can sort of smell the aroma of,
right, but when
nirvana.
Asked to describe the aroma of the mountaintop, they're going to describe it in different ways. This is the part that irks me, is that people who say, okay, we're all going up the same mountain, then you ask them, okay, what's at the top?
Mm-hmm.
And then they don't agree. So, I mean, it isn't like they're all describing, oh, we all go to the top, and then they have the same top. I mean, Christians are going to say, well, it's salvation, you know, with God. And Muslims are going to say it's submission to God. And Buddhists are going to say it's nirvana without suffering. So the mountaintops are very different.
We're going to get a theologian's voice in here in just a minute. A couple of calls first. Burnsville, North Carolina. Kanan, of all things. Kanan, you're on the air.
Hello,
hi, Kanan.
Tom and Stephen. How are you guys doing?
Very well.
Great.
I just had two brief points I wanted to share. I appreciate your expression, Stephen. And one is just this. It's interesting, something happens between science and religion, and you probably noticed this. Human opinion does not determine universal truth. Rather, we try to make our opinions on truth. I don't know anybody who would say, you know what, I view gravity a little bit differently than you. We all know it works the same. If I jump off a cliff, no matter what my opinion is, then my result is going to be the same as anyone else.
So would you say, Kanan, that God is one at the mountaintop or not?
Well, that actually had to do with the second point that I wanted to share. And it's interesting that, you know, among many professed Christians, that phrase has become very popular. But a lot of what Stephen is expressing, according to the Bible, is correct. I mean, this debate, you could say, has been going on for years, because Jesus Christ at one point had a discussion with a Samaritan woman who had a different religious view. But what he said was that his father, Jehovah God, wanted to be worshipped with spirit and with truth. And so, you know, the truths are there in the Bible. The problem, like Stephen mentioned, is instead of people trying to adjust themselves to the truth, it's like going into a tailor shop and they say, well, what religion fits me, what I personally want? That's all I wanted to express, but thank you very much.
Thank you, Kanan. Thank you very much. And we're gonna meditate on that and get one more right here. Rodney on I-65 in Kentucky, maybe driving a big rig there. Rodney, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, Tom. I caught your program about 20 miles ago, and I was just hoping that I could call in, and you were discussing the oneness of God type subject and format today.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm one of the what we call Assembly of God Christian. I came from atheism.
Mm-hmm.
That was my former belief system.
Yes.
That denies that there is no God, Satan, demons, angels, supernatural, any form of miraculous, these types of beliefs. But see, the Christian message is based on historical fact that a man named Jesus, there's various commentaries about him, but he did die on a cross and he rose from the dead. So that's the fundamental core of the Christian faith. And
But do you believe it's ultimately the same God that people of different religions are seeking?
No. Well, no. See, the fact about Jesus is what he said was he said clearly in Matthew's gospel, beware of false prophets. And polytheistic belief systems existed at the time of Christ and before the time of Christ. The Hindus, they worship many gods that each one has a different personality, dimension of power, but is not the Almighty and is not capable of creation and all these other things. So the Jews, I'm not a skinhead or a Nazi, of course. That's utterly ridiculous. Going around and genociding, killing off masses of people that don't want to become Christians is obviously anti-Christian. But
you're not really in the one God camp either. I can see that you're drawing lines there. Rodney, I appreciate your call, and stay safe right there. I want to get another voice in this conversation, if we may. Stephen Prothero's here with his book, God Is Not One. Joining us right now from Chicago is the Reverend Dr. Susan Brooks Thistlethwaite, ordained minister in the United Church of Christ, professor of theology at the Chicago Theological Seminary. She was president there for 10 years, from 98 to 2008. She writes a weekly column for the Washington Post's online On Faith section. Her new book is Dreaming of Eden, American Religion and Politics in a Wired World, coming out this fall. Susan Brooks Thistlethwaite, thank you very much for being with us today. Is there one God on the mountaintop or not?
Hello, Tom. Thanks so much for inviting me, and hello, Steve.
Hi, Susan.
I think that Steve's book should be called Religion Is Not One, because I think God is infinite. I believe God is infinite. So I think where the confusion creeps in is in relationship to people trying to express the inexpressible. And so I think it would be clarifying to be able to have people understand. I mean, religious differences are important. They are not all saying the same thing. And I think I teach as well as Steve teaches young people, and we've got this seeker generation of young people who I can tell you in my Religion in America class, I go around now every week and I ask the students, these are people preparing for ministry, and I ask them what their faith is, and they started to laugh about it because they may not be the same Protestant, mostly, tradition that they were the previous week. And there's a view among the millennial, your younger generation, that all religion is one big mush. And this, I think, is profoundly incorrect. But it's an article of faith that actually works in profound ways to teach people that beyond our religious differences, there is an infinite God that holds and binds us together as one people in one world, I think is indispensable to world peace.
Stephen Prothero, what do you say to that perspective?
Well, see, this is where you move from religious studies to theology. You know, I mean, if we're talking about, you know, and I talk about this perennialist view, as it's often called, the God is not one, you know, different paths up the same mountain view.
God is one.
Sorry.
Perennial philosophers,
right,
you're
exactly.
Say.
Thank you. Thank you, Tom. As a kind of theological imagination. In other words, it requires not looking at the world as it is, but it requires imagining the world in a different way. So it requires saying, you know, look, essentially what's happening here is they're all worshiping Jesus, or they're all worshiping Allah, or they're all trying to get at the Buddha. And I'm not denying that people can do that. Of course they do. And that's what Christian theologians on the liberal multicultural side will say, is that is what we just heard is okay, there are these different religious expressions, but in the end there's one God who created us all, and we need to realize that in order to get along. But the problem I have with that is how you fill in the there is blank, right? Because maybe
there is blank being.
Well, maybe there's the Amida Buddha, you know, who's created the Pure Land, you know, and this is a foretaste of the Pure Land. Or maybe there's just Krishna, and Krishna is the one God who wants us to be devoted to him and to sing songs and remember the way he danced with the Gopi girls.
And the idea that these can all be names for the infinite, as Susan might say, we'll ask her, but you don't buy that?
No, well, I think that's possible, but that's a theological proposition that, you know, can never be tested or even made sense of in this world. I mean, what we have is, what I'm interested in focusing on is ordinary religious people who are doing their religion, as has been done for millennia in many cases, and not telling them that what they're doing doesn't matter. You know, not saying to a Buddhist, oh, it doesn't really matter that you're meditating and trying to get rid of suffering, because really what you're doing is worshiping the one God whose name is Jesus, or worshiping the one God whose name we heard is Jehovah, or worshiping the one God whose name is Allah. I want people to... I'm interested in listening to these people and who tell me and taking them seriously when they tell me the very different doctrines, rituals, mythologies, and institutions that they have that drive and motivate their lives. Mm.
Susan Brooks Thistlethwaite, are you being disrespectful to the particular religions when you assert that at the end of the road there's one God?
Well, I kind of feel like the Scotsman who was asked, you know, do you believe in adult baptism? And he said, well, believe in it. I've seen it done. You know, I've got a long personal history of working across the boundaries of difference among religions, not to smush them together. Here, I believe Steve totally right about. But whether you look at another religion and you say heresy, or you look at another religion and you say, oh, good, more. And I think the world desperately needs people to look at the details, the intricacies, and the differences among the religions, but to say, oh, good, more. Because you'll never get there. I mean, the thing, you know, the downside of the mountaintop is when you're there, you're dead. So I think it's pointless to argue about the mountaintop. I think here in this world, in interfaith work, I mean, I worked on a Muslim-Christian anti-nuclear statement for the last UN Nuclear Non-Proliferation Conference, and the turning point was the recognition of the people at that conference that we, from our different religious perspectives, worshipped the same creator. And from that, we agreed to issue a statement condemning the development, production, deployment, and use of nuclear weapons. And there's hardly an issue in this world that's more important for people to cooperate on than no nukes.
Stephen, what do you say?
And yet, we don't all worship the same creator, because we have people in this world, including religious people, who don't believe in any god, and then we have people who don't believe in a creator god, as in, say, Confucianism and Buddhism and Taoism even. So that's the tricky part. When we get to that point where we want to say we're all the same because blah, it never really washes. We're always putting a blind eye to certain people. I'm a big fan of interfaith conversation. I feel that what I'm trying to foster is interfaith conversation. I'm not trying to torpedo it. But I have seen throughout my whole adult life interfaith conversations where the only people who were invited were basically liberals who bought into this Gandhian, Dalai Lama, Houston Smith idea, and no one else was allowed at the table. That meant no Orthodox Jews, no evangelical Christians, no serious Muslims, or at least traditional Muslims. And there is another way. There is a group called the Interfaith Youth Corps that operates in Chicago, not far from University of Chicago, where Professor Thistlethwaite teaches. And
I'm actually on the board of the Interfaith Youth Corps.
Exactly. And as you then know, you know, these are people who are able to get evangelicals, Orthodox Jews, and Muslims in the same room, because they don't demand that they leave their doctrinal and ritual differences at the door when they walk in.
And that's not a recipe for a brawl?
No, it isn't. It's a recipe. It's a recipe for...
That, I think, is where, because I've been committed to the Interfaith Youth Corps for quite a few years, and as I said, I'm actually a trustee. And I do think the not having to subscribe to a general OM in order to do interfaith work and to do the kind of interfaith service model that we do at Interfaith Youth Corps is critical. I think it's absolutely critical. But what I'm worrying about...
Susan Brooks Thistlethwaite, hold the worry if you'd be so kind. We have to take a break right here. Dreaming of Eden is her book coming out this fall. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about whether religions are all different paths to the same God. My guest today says no. Stephen Prothero is a professor of religion at Boston University, and his new book is God is Not One. Susan Brooks Thistlethwaite is also with us. She was president of the Chicago Theological Seminary for 10 years until 2008. She'll be out with her new book, Dreaming of Eden, this fall. She's now senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. She joins us from Chicago. Lots of comments online and at Facebook. Ellen says, I like to say religion is the lens we use to view, but that what we view is necessarily the same thing. Daniel says, you run into this problem when you place too many limitations on God, quote-unquote. If you over-define God, then it does look very different. Ariel says, Jesus, Krishna, Muhammad, Buddha, etc. are not gods. They are all prophets of the one universal God, Father, Mother that does exist. And John says, they're all equally false. So there's the range of views for you. Susan, I had to interrupt you there at the break. You were coming to a worry here.
Yes, I was. It's the subtitle, Stephen, the eight rival religions that run the world. And I really think the last thing the world needs for us to emphasize is rivalry amongst religion. And even descriptively among these eight, and looking at religious studies as more descriptive, why eight rival religions? Why did you say that?
Well, because they are. Because the religions have been competing for millennia, and because they're different. We talked briefly about atheism. I mean, atheism comes in here too. You know, one of the problems I see with the new atheism is it tends to lump all the religions together as well.
That is the kind of angry anti-religious atheism. Yeah,
that's
Hitchens
right.
Et al.
And it's saying, you know, all religion is the same. It's all basically poison. And what you're hearing from this more kind of multicultural, all religions are, you know, going to the same mountaintop, mm-hmm. is also all religions are the same and they're basically good. And
so you're saying some are good and some are poison?
That's right. I think all religions, are both toxic and tonic. All religions are poisonous in some ways, are evil in some ways, and are good in some ways. And I think it's incorrect to line them up, you know, on one side of that spectrum. But it's also wrong. The atheists are wrong to just see the evil in religion, and the sort of all religions are fabulous and beautiful and true and one. Folks are wrong to see just the good in religion. We should see the similarities and the differences, and we should see the good and the evil in the religions. And so often our conversations about religion are driven by ideology rather than by reality. And it might be a liberal one, it might be a conservative one, but we need to just look at religions how they are. And how they are is they are rivals. They have been rivals for some time.
Susan, maybe it is condescending to say, oh, we shouldn't emphasize the differences or the rivalry because that's the last thing we need. That may be true, but it could simultaneously be true that those differences are deeply felt and held.
I don't think those two things are mutually exclusive. I am certain that the vast majority of the religious people around the world deeply hold their views and that they are quite specific and distinct. Two things. One is the paradigms, the problem is sin, for example, in Christianity, the solution is salvation, Buddhism, the problem is suffering, the solution is awakening. They are, in a very, very broad sense, I think, not inaccurate. However, you know, what do you do with somebody like Reinhold Niebuhr, who also thought, Steve, the problem was pride? I mean, there are an awful lot of differences internal to these religious paradigms, some of which around the boundaries, even descriptively, not even saying, you know, proscriptively in terms of belief and my conviction about the infinite nature of God, but just descriptively, there are people on the boundaries among these religions who are closer to each other in terms of what they believe than your paradigms would suggest.
On the boundaries, yes, but in a way, Stephen, you make the point in the book that in the main is what you're focused on. In the main, they may be different.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are people inside the religions who are closer maybe to people in other religions than to most of the people in their own. That's true. But that also, in some ways, reinforces the point of religious diversity. Not only do we have tremendous diversity that we all too often ignore between, say, Buddhists and Hindus and Christians, but we also have tremendous diversity inside them. That's what the point I was trying to make about Shia and Sunni, that it's a recipe for disaster to imagine that all Muslims are the same. How can we act in the world economically, politically, or militarily if we imagine that all Muslims are the same? And so the point about Niebuhr is, yeah, there's a tremendous diversity inside Christianity, and that's true. But that only makes my point that religious difference is something we need to account for and deal with rather than pretending, oh, all Christians are the same or all Christians and Muslims are together
the same. But that really seems to me to draw the cover of what Houston Smith and Gandhi and Dalai Lama have said too widely. I mean, they're talking about the mountaintop. They're talking about some kind of ultimate expression, right? Some kind of ultimate awareness. I mean, I wonder, in reading the book, I was listening very closely for your own perspective in all this. And clearly, you know the religions inside and out. It's a great kind of primer to the shape and form and expression of each one. I love it at that level. But I don't sense that you're necessarily extremely religious yourself. And maybe in that you're not in touch with that final altitude of, you know, call it whatever you will, where it all merges. Maybe you don't go there.
Well, you mean, maybe I'm not a mystic who has seen the infinite and felt the infinite in my own experience.
I mean, I think
I would be the first person to admit I'm not a mystic. And in fact, I just wrote a piece on killingthebuddha.com that's called Why I'm Not a Mystic. So I'd be perfectly willing to admit that. I will say that at the end of almost every chapter in this book, I give voice to mysticism. I think I'm fascinated by mysticism. I think Sufi mysticism is in the Islamic tradition is intriguing. I end that chapter with voices like Rumi and Hafiz and other mystics. I find the mystical claims to be wonderful, and I think they're actually part of religious diversity. What I don't want to do is to allow mystics to define the religions. It's not fair. I mean, and I think it betrays a Protestant and Christian bias that religion is essentially about this experience of these great medieval Catholic or mystics who have somehow merged their self into the self of God. And I'm not denying
that. That's hardly only in Protestantism or Christianity.
No, but it's the tendency of Protestantism to say that religion is essentially about belief. And to say merger with God,
you might call that belief, but you might not. I have to call a little time out and get our listeners in because there's so many clamoring to join. Forgive me, but it's their show. Julie in Brantford, Connecticut. Julie, you're on.
Hello, thank you. I just wanted to say that I agree wholeheartedly with Steve, and I find his position incredibly refreshing. Mm-hmm. I am one of those people that he refers to who is a common person deeply embedded in a religion and am keenly aware of the differences between what I believe and, for example, what my family members believe, who are of a different persuasion. And I think that this is analogous to race relations in the United States, where we thought that the solution for racial intolerance and ethnic intolerance was to be colorblind and to say, you know what, we're really all the same. Mm. And we realized that doesn't work. We need to appreciate that people have different cultures, different languages, different, you know, physical characteristics, and that...
What's your religious practice, Julie, if I may ask?
I'm a Buddhist.
Do you believe that there's a God?
I believe that that's an irrelevant question.
There you go. Stephen is nodding. Yeah, okay.
Which is why I think it's not necessary to invoke a creator God to see that nuclear proliferation, for example, is a bad idea. It's not necessary, and it is marginalizing, and it is insulting. I think it does condescend to people outside of the Judeo-Christian religion.
It's a perfect contribution.
Muslims
Thank you, Julie.
Christians working together, then that's contradictory what you're saying, because we as Christians and Muslims, not speaking for all religions in the world, but we specific believers who were both liberal and very, very conservative from both traditions found that an important thing to do, not prescriptively for every other religion in the world. So the difference point on that project actually pertains.
And you know, hallelujah, if I may use that Christian loaded phrase. But anyway, thank heavens, everything's kind of loaded, but for those efforts, that kind of effort is very important, whether you believe there's one at the end of the road or not. Diane in Lansing, Michigan. Diane, thank you for joining us.
Hello. Thank you for this moment. I want to ask a question in the sense that how can a person have peace and harmony with their fellow human being if they have any shadow of mistrust or doubt about the other person? And when you have a religious identity of some kind, as Catholic, Protestant, Buddhist, whatever, mm-hmm. atheist, then the other person not having that identity becomes a different species that you are open to mistrusting. And in the mystical sense, there is something that we can all experiment with. We can all see that there is, in the end, this possibility of union. Mm-hmm. For example, when we see beauty in nature, we mm-hmm. drop our little petty selves and our little assumptions. Mm-hmm. We're struck by the magnificent sunrise or sunset, and all that drops away, and we just have this purity of being. And in that purity of being, and there is no mistrust, there is no identification with any particular religious belief or system, and one can experiment with that and find out if it's true or not. Does belief in religion lead to disharmony and war and all that nasty thing?
So religion itself comes into question in that perspective. Susan, that's beautifully put, and I appreciate your call very much. Let me get another, if I may, and we'll come back to my guest, Haverhill, Massachusetts. Helen. Helen, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I've been listening, and for many years I've been investigating and exploring exactly what you're discussing. To me, the question is not, is God one? To me, the question, or is the statement, God is not one? Mm-hmm. To me, the premise is, truth is one. From everything that I've studied and explored, all the religions, through ritual, are encouraging people to enter into this ritual as a way to get in touch with truth. And I think it's also true that the varieties of religions, in all of their multitudinous varieties of ways, are challenging people to apply what you find to be true into your daily life in order that we can...
Does that lead to harmony? Are the truths, you know, do the truths converge at some point in your view, Helen, or do we end up with distinct warring truths even?
Oh, well, I don't use the word warring at all. Mm-hmm. I think it is, as other people have spoken, the religions really wish people to practice tolerance and respect, even though the subtitle may be rivalries. I do think that I have learned that all the religions do basically teach tolerance and respect, and that the journey is the point, that we through ritual, come to some truths and try to apply them in our daily lives and therefore lead lives that are more fulfilling.
Helen, we've got it, and I appreciate your call. Stephen Prothero, to my ear, Helen is working hard there to kind of almost synthesize your view and its opposite. I say it with respect, but you feel the urge not to lose track or hold of this notion of something in common.
Yeah, I mean, I want to add one more point about how we really aren't in sort of climbing out of this sort of rabbit hole of unreality of the union of all religions, how we're not leading to world conflagration here. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that one of the thing that happens as you look at the differences, like I tried to do in this book, is that you start to appreciate the unique beauty of each tradition. And the unique beauty of each tradition gets lost and really cut out as you try to shove them all into commonality.
You call it beauty, but the history books are full of war built on what can be beautiful religions, and not just Muslim and Christian, but Hindu and Buddhist. I mean, even in very recent memory.
Of course, and I talk about that in the book, and I think the question is, how do we avoid that? And one answer is, we should pretend that the religions are basically the same, even though almost all religious practitioners, like the Buddhist we heard from today, know that that's false. And we can imagine that proceeding on the basis of a falsehood is a way to make for world harmony. I don't believe that. Maybe that's because I'm an academic or an intellectual. I just think ignorance and misunderstanding is not a way to proceed. But I'm not at all unhopeful here. I think that as we look at the religious differences, that we can move beyond this paradigm, as the caller said, about, oh, the only way for the races to get together is to pretend that race doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. The only way for religions to get together is to pretend that religious difference doesn't matter. I don't believe that's true. I think we can look at the differences just like we do in our human relationships, and we can see them, and we can even start to appreciate them and respect them. And that's the way to go forward instead of this pretense, this sort of pretend pluralism that all the religions are basically the same.
Susan, how do you see the answer? If God is not one, can you live with that? And can we still find harmony under that? Or could that even be the only way to harmony, to see differences, embrace them, and go from there?
Well, go back to your gentleman caller who self-identified as Assemblies of God.
Mm-hmm.
And I ask myself, what is my best way? Someone who holds a different view, he says it's a historical fact, Jesus rose from the dead. What is the best way for me to engage him in a religiously pluralistic America?
Mm-hmm.
Is it to continue to emphasize how different his Assemblies of God faith is from mine in the United Church of Christ? Or is it to try to find, not fake, I agree with Stephen there, not fantastical, but actual areas of commonality? And I think we're short on commonality. I think we're long on fake tolerance. I agree with that. But I think that the issue is religions are not one. God, however, I think is one.
Susan Brooks Thistlethwaite at the Chicago Theological Seminary. Thank you very much for being with us today, Susan.
Thank you.
And Stephen Prothero, this is not a conversation that we will finish today, but it's been really wonderful. The new book is God is Not One. Thank you, Stephen, for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us, listeners. It's great to have you. This is On Point.